Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at Twitch. The biggest live streaming platform in the world is struggling to turn a profit. And now reports suggest that parent company Amazon could be losing patience in the project that it purchased for almost $1 billion a decade ago. The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
The following programme contains strong adult themes.
Sex is very important. It would be, for most of us, the only opportunity that we do get. So, yeah, if you're going to be shackling yourself, for want of a better word, to a person to say, you're going to be my one sexual partner for the rest of my life, which is not always the case, alhamdulillah, or, you know, as the case might be. No, because, I mean, yeah, let's be real. This is a safe space.
Meet Musia, mother, writer, doctor, student, and sex educator.
I like you. She's very straightforward. I am going to add that to my repertoire. Okay, anybody else has?
You're listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Geeta Pensay, and for Heart and Soul, which explores personal approaches to faith and spirituality from around the world, I'm talking to Mutia and finding out about the groundbreaking women working as Muslim sex educators.
So you're coming in, for example, in your hijab or whatever. Sometimes just the act of removing your hijab makes you, it feels very, you know, uncomfortable for you. Get used to that. Get used to touching each other.
But they often face opposition from the very community that they're trying to help. So what drives them to talk about a topic that many of us shy away from? And has their faith helped or challenged them along the way? I'm arriving at the station where I've agreed to meet Mutia. After living in her native Nigeria and then working in Saudi Arabia, I'm curious to see how Mutia has found life working, studying and running her sex education workshops here in the UK.
The next train to arrive at Platform 11, this train is formed of five coaches. You can find the shop in Coach D for delicious hot and cold refreshments.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. How are you today?
I'm fine. Still cold. I'm waiting for the summer, but fine.
Summer doesn't always come in this country.
Yeah, unfortunately, I learned that.
This is Mutia Badruddin, a 40-something Nigerian mother of three and experienced doctor. Dressed in a black niqab with a shawl over the top and a silver pleated skirt. I'll be honest, she's not what I imagined a sex educator might look like. But Mutia runs workshops and lectures on sexual and reproductive health awareness. Right now, she's studying creative writing as well as building her new social enterprise working on sex education. So we're coming into, is this one of your lecture rooms?
It's actually the lecture theatre in the Enterprise Centre. So I have over 18 years of experience in obstetrics and gynaecology, mostly in Nigeria and in Saudi Arabia. And one thing that became very obvious to me very quickly was the fact that women generally, but Muslim women in particular, do not know enough about their body. And that is being me being generous. They do not know anything about their bodies.
Mutia has delivered these workshops in different parts of the world, with her most recent here, where she's currently studying.
Half of the time I'm dealing with just like issues that maybe not totally prevented, but would have been mitigated by just access to proper information and support.
To give me a sense of what Mutia does, she let me listen in on one of her workshops.
Do we understand what I just said? Or because I see some people looking at me like, okay, isn't that what he's supposed to be doing? No, that's not what he's supposed to be doing. That's not what he's supposed to be doing. And that's my point. The basic knowledge is the next thing you want to talk about. Do you know your body?
I asked Mutia how she decides what to talk about in the workshops.
Oh, literally anything. And as long as it is related to sexual and reproductive health, there is no topic that is out of bounds. So sometimes it's parents who want to talk about, you know, how do I talk about to my kids about sex? And sometimes it's like the one here, young women who want to know, how do I approach a discussion with a potential partner on sexual and reproductive health?
Do you think there are specific barriers for Muslim women?
Oh, definitely there are specific barriers for Muslim women. There's the very idea that you're even talking about it in the first instance is a barrier because people look at you sideways. I've had that judgment, you know, where people are like, but why are you talking about that? That's supposed to be behind closed doors. And I'm like, no, this is health. We are talking about health here. And then there's the fact that, you know, the information, the research, the science sometimes doesn't align with the things that you hold to be true to your faith. And so being able to navigate that, being able to say, well, that might be true scientifically, but I'm not going to do that as a Muslim, for example. It's not something that a lot of people want to confront. This is not something to be ashamed about. I know that there's been a veil of shame around our societies when it comes to issues of sexuality, but this is, you're literally going towards what is halal for you. This is the only way that it is halal for you, which is why I brought up earlier. Then you should have no shame around having serious conversations. And again, because it's something that's going to affect all of your lives.
Mutia's faith is in no way lightly held. As niqabi, she wears a full face veil. And it was clear to me as we walked towards each other at the station that she stands out. I wanted to ask how she addresses that gap between her students' faith and what most people understand as the science of sex education.
Okay, so the idea around, and I'm going to be very extreme here, the idea about exploring your sexuality and within consenting couples, for example. In Islam, it's a no-no for you to have anal sex. Like, that's totally prohibited. Like, if you were having those kind of conversations with a partner, for example, how do you then navigate it? Because in, you know, mainstream spaces, they'll be like, well, we trust and have a conversation. And that is not to say that Muslims don't have those desires. It's just acknowledging them and also acknowledging that as Muslims, we are limited, if we choose to be, by the restrictions of our religion and being able to live with that and accept that.
And a lot of what you do is around sexual health. Does pleasure matter?
Oh, definitely. One of the main pushback I get is the fact that, you know, people think that sex should be for recreation. Some people think that. And I am all for women asking and demanding for sexual pleasure, which riles up some people. But yeah, it definitely, in my opinion, it matters because we are a community that is very strict on issues of sexuality. So if you were to follow all of these strictures, you as a Muslim woman will have only this one man, this one person to fulfill your sexual desires. He should be giving you pleasure. Otherwise, what are you doing? So, yeah.
I mean, I can't see your face, but I feel like you are smiling here because I'm definitely smiling and agreeing inside.
The women companions of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam talked about sex. They talked about sex in the mosques, in open gatherings of men and women. There are narrations of women who divorced their husband because he wasn't satisfying them sexually just so they could be married to somebody else. Like I said, if you're not interested in what I'm talking about, what I'm trying to do, that's all well and good. Just, you know, I'm here for the people who are.
And the workshops that you've run in Nigeria as well as here in the UK, are there differences in knowledge of the Muslim women that you've met?
Interestingly, no. I'm flabbergasted. When I started this project, it was just a month before I left Nigeria. I had the idea that, you know, it was something that was needed in Nigeria and it was something that was needed in Saudi Arabia and really all of the Arab countries where I'd been for so long. But coming to the UK, I thought you guys have a fantastic network of just like sexual and reproductive health. I didn't need to do anything. And then I started talking to Muslim women here and I found out that, oh my God, there is no difference. We are all the same.
Why do you think that is?
It's definitely cultural. There's the weaponization of shame, this idea of modesty and haya and shame and not talk about stuff and, you know, that's something for the bedroom and all of which is true, but it's not the entire truth. My work here is just to say, yeah, this is the safe space where we can do have those conversations.
Talking to Mutia is fascinating. She's clearly a powerhouse and inspired by so many aspects of her life. But I wanted to know more about this woman who wears the niqab and how she ended up teaching sex education to other Muslim women.
There was a lot of pushback from my medical school. The people who were most virulent in the way they reacted to me and my presenting, so obviously Muslim, were the surgeons. Anyway, so the idea of working with only women was fascinating to me. So I think that's why I fell into obstetrics and gynecology. There's history there, there's context there, all of that. And I try not to let that hold me back. I just do what I want to do anyways. Understanding that, yes, there are limitations that come with how I choose to present. Not that the niqab limits me. It's usually people's reaction to the niqab, people's perception of the niqab, people's thoughts of what should be allowed to a woman in niqab that limits me. But, you know, it's a choice I keep making every day.
And here in the UK, currently, you've got this project of yours. You founded this social enterprise. What made you decide to set this up?
When I took a step back from full-time clinical medicine, and I started talking to people around me, and I started getting responses that people, they want that service, Muslims especially, they want that service, but they don't feel safe, they don't feel welcome in the mainstream spaces. There's a lot of messaging, a lot of ideas that they feel are being rammed down their throats, which might not align with their beliefs, with their faith systems. So I thought, okay, maybe I will do that. And having the support of the team, yeah, it just seemed like the right time to start.
And it's not just here at this university in the UK where these pioneering lessons are taking place.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's me, the Villajanti, coming back with a quick video. Now look, this is something that we absolutely need to have a conversation about, sisters. So, since this week we are talking about raw vegetables, a raw lifestyle, and week 3 for passage, I decided to stop by the market and get some vegetables to use as visual aids. So let's get raw.
This is the documentary from the BBC World Service.
911, what is your emergency?
Most towns have a local celebrity.
Who is it that's missing?
It's my dad. He went out into the water.
An eccentric known throughout the community.
Inverness market trader Kim Avis.
Kim Avis.
Kim Avis.
Inverness revolved around Kim in a way.
Difference is, the local eccentric from my hometown made international headlines.
The man's son reported he disappeared in treacherous water.
Search and rescue teams thought they had yet another drowning on their hands. Or did they?
The story's not adding up.
He is completely unhinged.
It was violent, it was controlling, it was sadistic.
Dead Man Running, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Geeta Pensay, and for this episode of Heart and Soul, I'm about to have a video call with Angelica, aka the Village Auntie. She's doing something similar to Mutia, but in Phoenix, Arizona, in the United States. Where did she start to get the idea that there was a need for this?
Hi, Geeta.
Hello, how are you? I have to say, I had this feeling that you were going to wear a really impressive outfit and You're in this like stunning pink hijab, this beautiful colour. So you've definitely got like 10 out of 10 for outfit. No one will be able to see this. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you.
Through her online presence as Village Auntie, Angelica hosts workshops and posts online videos, offering her 63,000 followers advice on sex, pleasure, and things of all shapes and sizes.
It was all left to the decree of Allah, and this is what he wound up with. I hope this little vegetable lesson has been helpful. If it is, drop me a comment below. Assalamu alaikum.
The following programme contains strong adult themes. So I've got so many questions for you, and I have to say I've been stalking you on social media and watching lots of your video and content, and really want to get into the work that you're doing, which is clearly having a huge influence and impact. How important was faith and Islam in your upbringing?
It was not a part of my upbringing because I was raised in the church. I was raised Christian. I'm still the only Muslim in my family. I converted to Islam at the age of 23. I had started studying when I was 19, so I was at university. And I actually started studying to disprove some of the conclusions of my then boyfriend who was considering Islam. I was trying to show him that Islam could not possibly be the way. And in the midst of my studies, I began to find a lot of resonance with what I already believed faith-wise. And fun fact, he never became Muslim, but I did.
So what took you from there to deciding to be a Muslim sex educator?
So 2 weeks after I took my shahada to become a Muslim, I was sexually assaulted. And I had a choice at that point. I could either lean into my new faith, or I could demean an entire faith based on the actions of one person. I decided to do the former. And in leaning into my faith, I wanted to know, what does Islam say about sex? What does Islam say about sexual assault? What does Islam say about a woman's bodily agency? And that led me down a path of learning about Islamic jurisprudence, fiqh. It led me down a path of learning about how much ownership we have over our bodies, how important women are. And I really started this work because I needed to heal myself. And then later in life, when I shifted from being a classroom teacher to public health, it was just the three of those things, public health, culture, and religion, just combined for me to take the path that I'm on right now.
It was difficult to hear what Angelica has been through, and empowering to see how it's influenced her work now. With such a big profile online, I was curious to find out how people outside of her audience respond to what she does.
When I first came out, I would get death threats. I would get rape threats. I would get people who would say things like, you know, your mother should have, you know, aborted you. Just very vicious, vicious rumors and vicious, you know, statements. So it was very hard at first. But I kept pushing because I knew that because of the violent reaction that I first got, I knew that I hit on something that needed to be excavated, healed, and worked through in our community.
What would you say, though, to those who do really hold quite dear that idea of modesty, that Muslim women should not be speaking about these subjects in the public sphere, perhaps maybe in their homes, but not so publicly, and they feel that you're bringing Islam into disrepute?
I think it's interesting when people take that stance, and usually people who take that stance about my work are people who have never really engaged with it. They hear Angelica is a Muslim sex educator, and then they make up that, you know, their imagination runs wild. So I think it's the perception of what I might say that triggers people more than what I actually say. I actually had a sister tell me, she said, you know, I was really prepared to write you off. She was just being a hack who wanted to, you know, disparage Islam. But she said, I was so struck at how professional you are and how informed you are. And I had to tell her, I'm a Muslim, but I'm also a public health professional. Our religion is full of hadith about the exact things that I'm talking about. And part of me inviting people to investigate is not just inviting them to investigate their sexual health. It's inviting them to explore the depth and the breadth of our religious tradition.
It was fascinating to me to hear how Angelica's faith helped her through the trauma of her sexual assault and to spur on her sexual health work. In fact, both Angelica and Mutia have found ways to channel their experiences of trauma and loss into building their faith and helping others.
My father died when I was 19. It was horrible and traumatic and everything you could possibly imagine. And for a while, I was lost. And my father was the center of my world. Everything I liked was because my father liked it, or liked it for me. Everything I hated was because my father hated or hated for me. I was just daddy's little girl.
Mutia's character is strong, but beyond her composure and poise, I can see that talking about the loss of her father is still very emotional for her. She told me that after he died, she moved closer to her faith and took the decision to wear the niqab.
Trying to navigate my way back to some sense, I connected with my religion a bit more. And so I started doing that at 19, and I don't think it's compulsory for every Muslim woman, but that wasn't what this was about. It was a thing between me and my Lord, and it just felt right, so I did it. Initially, my family was happy when I first started becoming more outwardly religious. They kind of saw it as a grounding of, you know, the girl that I had been after my father died, which was lost and wild and just lost. They had high hopes for me. I suppose there was that preconception around women who wear niqab and what your prospects for the future was, and, you know, me picking that up in my fifth year of medical school was just like, oh, she truncated her future. What's she going to do now? If I had become this woman in niqab, oof, my father would have hated it. And unlike my mother, who is the most patient woman I know, he would have fought me. He would have fought me hard. And I don't know how we would have survived that. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword. Knowing that I am this woman I am because of the way he loved me. And that gave me the confidence to be who I am. I don't see barriers. Or when I do see them, I have to figure out, is it worth it? If it is, I will barrel down those barriers.
As we were chatting, it began to strike me just how much Mutia and Angelica had in common, from their past experiences living and working in Saudi Arabia to their real commitment to helping others despite facing backlash. Both were aware of each other through their social media work, but had never met before, so I decided to bring them together.
Hi, Mutia.
Walaikum salam rahma, village auntie. Lovely to meet you.
Yes, nice to meet you too. How are you?
Have a couple of girlies in my life who are always talking about you. Oh, village auntie said. Village auntie said that. It's very interesting.
It's so funny because some of my students from Saudi follow me now. And at first I was worried how they would react to the work that I do. But since I left in 2015, a lot of them are, they're adults now because I taught high school. Yeah. So some of them are mothers and wives, and they've all just said how helpful it's been to have this information.
Because that space is not there at all in Saudi Arabia. It is so closed.
But there's such a need for, I think, that kind of conversation. I had two babies. I wish I would have known. I would have come to find you. I had two babies in Saudi Arabia. And even my experience in the hospitals, there was so much, like, people were afraid to have conversations about, because I had some pretty traumatic births, but we still were, there was a lot of shame
still
around
having the conversation. Yes. I had a similar conversation in my last workshop, which was just a group of young ladies, mostly in their late teens, early 20s, unmarried university students. And we're talking about how to navigate, you know, having a conversation about sexual and reproductive health with a prospective spouse. And there were people from certain cultures who were like, oh, I couldn't ever say that. They're going to go back home and say bad things about me. It's going to bring disgrace to my family. And I'm like, you know, first and foremost, you should be saying that because this involves your body, the most vulnerable space you're ever going to be able to be in. And you don't want to have that conversation, just go in blind. That makes no sense. So I'm like, yeah, we're doing this.
Yeah. Yeah, that struck me when the question about Can you ask a prospective spouse these sexual and reproductive health questions? I always tell sisters, like, you would much rather have a class with me or with you before marriage than have to suffer through months of counseling afterwards because you didn't ask these questions.
Years afterwards, years of silence, of frustration. You know where they come to unload? In the OB/GYN consulting room. Oh. We have experiences for months, I'm sure, so let's not even go there.
It's amazing sitting and listening to Monsieur and Angelica talk like they've known each other for years. And I started to wonder how similar the reactions have been to the work that they do.
I did want to know how you got started, though, because I was fascinated. I wasn't on social media until 2020. People send you filth. I don't know if you have that experience, but I had to shut down our DMs.
Same. I have to. I don't take DMs from people that I don't follow or that I don't know personally.
Yeah, anymore. Because I post out DMs too, because like, there's so much filth out there.
Twitter, it was just between the DMs with the most egregious messaging and it was just a lot. And one of the things that I think that a lot of people took issue to was the fact that I wear a hijab and that I'm visibly Muslim. How have people responded to you? Like, do you feel like people take umbrage with the work that you do because of how you present?
I just ignore them.
Before I left these two women, I wanted to know if they had any lasting pieces of advice for each other, for their work and in their faith.
With my business, one of the things that I've come to understand is even though I am the brand with my business, it's very important for me to have a dividing line between Village Auntie and Angelica. Mm-hmm. Like my home life, I don't, when I go live or I do videos, I'm always in one place because that's the sanctity of my home is important. If I may give like advice as you grow this, I think you're on the perfect track to maintaining those boundaries because people will push those boundaries.
Yeah, when it comes I definitely try to do that because I talk about my kids a lot, but I don't mention their names.
You know, it also has helped because, you know, since I've been online for a while, there are people who, some of whom I've never met in person, by the way, but some of my students, I don't even have a chance to get to the negative comment before I see one of my students has responded or has said, you know, you don't have to read, you could have kept scrolling. So I love that the communities that we are developing become self-correcting.
Exactly. You know, I love that. And that's the thing I always tell people, like, I'm not interested in converting anybody from whatever ideology you want to hold or whatever. I'm interested in the people who want the things that I'm doing. All of those things, I will not debate my humanity with you. I will not debate my agency with anyone. You know, move on. We need to be our own community.
It's amazing. I love that. I'm going to have to use that one day. I'll credit you. When someone comes at me, I'm going to say, I will not debate my humanity with you. I love that. What a thing to live by.
Thank you.
I love that so much. Oh, wow.
This edition of Heart and Soul was presented by me, Geeta Pense. The editor was Rajiv Gupta and the producer was Linda Walker.
What is your emergency?
Most towns have a local celebrity.
Who is it that's missing?
It's my dad. He went out into the water.
An eccentric known throughout the community.
Inverness market trader Kim Avis.
Kim Avis.
Kim Avis.
Inverness revolved around Kim in a way.
Difference is, the local eccentric from my hometown made international headlines.
The man's son reported he disappeared in treacherous water.
Search and rescue teams thought they had yet another drowning on their hands. Or did they?
The story's not adding up.
He is completely unhinged.
It was violent. It was controlling. It was sadistic.
Dead Man Running, wherever you get your podcasts.